Well, our first fully post-election week is over. We took on some pretty weighty topics, a fight over water between Georgia and Florida, the continuing fallout from said election, and the death penalty. So, as we do every Friday, we've gathered a group of smart people to help us kick back, unwind, and think about what the heck happened this week. It's time for the break room.
The idea that, you know, fake news on Facebook influenced the election in any way, I think, is a pretty crazy idea.
That's Oxford's word of the year, post-truth.
Post-truth is clearly just a ripoff of my 2006 word of the year, truthiness.
If you caught Trump on the campaign trail at all, and you listened very carefully, you may remember some very subtle hints he had about a wall.
Joining us in the break room are Kalina Bowler, co-host of the Real Snobs podcast, Hector Fernandez, director of the Center for Latin American and Latino Studies at Georgia State University, Natalie Pavelski, vice president and senior writer at the Cater Communications firm, and with us on Skype is John Jackson. He's a veteran and he's a farmer in Milledgeville. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday.
Happy Hello. Friday.
Happy Friday, guys.
Oh, all right. Skype is on from Milledgeville. We're excited about that. Okay. Since the presidential election happened, we have been hearing a lot about this.
E-L-E-C-T-O-R-A-L. Electoral College. And we deserve a Yale.
Not that kind of Yale.
Yeah. Donald Trump can thank the Electoral College for his victory in the presidential race. He won more than 270 electoral votes and beat Hillary Clinton, but the popular votes are still being counted, and Clinton has at least a million more votes than Trump at this moment. The Electoral College gives states with small populations a larger voice in the process. There are now renewed calls to abolish it, with legislation introduced by Democrats in both the House and the Senate. It would take a constitutional amendment, of course. So, folks, is it time to start talking about making changes to the Electoral College or ditching it altogether? Natalie?
Oh, absolutely. It should be one person, one vote. I mean, why should my vote not count as much as some ranchers in Wyoming, or vice versa for that matter? I mean, it's not going to change because it's benefited Republicans twice in the past couple decades. I mean, it's, you know, Gore won the popular vote as well. But look, this is a system that's a result of 18th century bargaining and the unholy three-fifths compromise thrown in for good measure. It's profoundly undemocratic and it should change.
Is there not some legitimacy to the argument that small states would likely be forgotten in our political process were it not for the extra weight they were given in the presidential election? Hector?
So be it. I mean, some of these states are statistically insignificant. I mean, it's not our fault if their population really, you know, doesn't have to wait. And right now they're being given outlandish importance. So if you ask me, Electoral College has to go.
John, are you going to be a dissenting voice?
Yes, I am. Well, I think, you know, these are the rules of the game. And the Republicans have played these rules very, very well. But make no mistake about it. If the Electoral College was to be diminished and we went with more of the one person, one vote, that I would have no doubt that Donald Trump would still win that. He would have changed
That's
the way that—
That's not the point, though.
I think he would have changed his ground game up to support his win. And so anything, whether it's the popular vote or the electoral vote, the candidate will compete on that level and do well.
On the other hand, Kalina, I mean, isn't it the case that if you're, say, you're a Democrat or mm-hmm. you're anyone who is dismayed by Donald Trump's victory, isn't this sort of rhetorically speaking, this is a bad moment to argue for the dissolution of the Electoral College? You want to make that argument you want to make the argument for any change to electoral process when it's going to disadvantage your side as opposed to advantage your side, because otherwise, doesn't it just look like you've got sour grapes?
You know, sadly, I have to say I agree to a certain extent. I remember when President Obama won his two terms, there were a lot of people on the right saying, "No, Electoral College needs to be looked at again." And we tend to do
that. Let's remember that when Obama won re-election, his popular vote victory over Mitt Romney was wasn't that great, but his Electoral College victory was enormous, right? Mm-hmm. And at the time, you had conservative voices saying, we need to ditch the Electoral College. Maybe if you advocate for the dissolution of the Electoral College, the time now is to be, if you're a Democrat, is to be quiet and find and amplify the voices of those conservatives who argued for it 4 years ago.
Well, we can say that, but we can also say that, okay, if the people on the right and the Republicans were saying this back when Obama was winning, and then we're saying this now, people on the left are saying this now, both sides are saying there's something that needs to be done about the Electoral College. I mean, the length of time between those two arguments is noted, but people are really, really starting to realize that the Electoral College is something that's antiquated. It's not something that benefits people. It was something that absolutely benefited people that were just white male landowners back in the day when it was first, you know, brought about. So there is absolutely something that needs to be changed, and it's all right to go back and look at the Constitution. This is my own opinion. I believe it's right to go back and look back at the Constitution and say, okay, how can we stick to what makes our democracy unique and form a more perfect union?
We have an amendment process for a reason. All right, let's move on. Social media networks are under fire for enabling the spread of fake news stories, particularly in this recently concluded election season. Some critics even say that misinformation spread thusly may have swayed voters during the campaign. At a conference last week, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg called these claims, quote, a pretty crazy idea. But former Facebook employee Antonio Garcia Martinez told NPR's All Tech Considered that his advertising team used to joke about how easy it would be to manipulate an election. Let's listen.
There's an entire political team and a massive office in D.C. that tries to convince political advertisers that Facebook can convince users to vote one way or the other. And then Zuck gets up and says, oh, by the way, Facebook content couldn't possibly influence the election. I mean, it's contradictory on the face of it.
Now, since then, Facebook and Google have both said that they're going to try to tackle this problem a bit by restricting ads on fake news sites. I suppose we can all agree that fake news is bad and real news is good, but do we think that fake news really is as big a factor as it has been made out to be in recent days, John?
I mean, you got Snopes, which most of us look at like, what in the heck is going on? I mean,
yeah, Snopes is a site that fact checks memes and other sort of questionable viral content on the internet, and they do a pretty good job.
Yeah, we don't. Particularly, you're right with the whole the fake news thing is a really, really big problem. I don't think it has any sway on how we actually vote. More, if you look on my feed and in my network, people like to fact check themselves or fact check the stuff that comes through. And I honestly think that there should be something to do about it because it wastes people time with regards to finding real news. And they should have some sort of clause on there that says, you know, whether it's satire or whatever, instead of spewing that.
Yeah, certainly there are some satire sites that I wonder if they really are intended to be read as satire, or if the people writing the articles are hoping that the people reading them will be duped into thinking that they're real and share them. That said, Natalie, going back to our original question, do you think that fake news played any kind of significant role in the outcome of this election that we've just had?
Given what I heard from some people who I love dearly, but who I disagree with violently in terms of politics, oh, yeah.
Violently.
Look, the thing is, even if whether it did or did not sway this particular election, it matters because this is the thing. News informs public opinion, and in a democracy, public opinion is the basis of that democracy. So you look, for example, this one analysis, they looked at Facebook, they looked at the top 20 political stories from real news sites and the top 20 political stories from fake news sites over the course of the election, right? The last few months, the fake news outperformed real news. So stories like Pope Francis endorses Trump, which, by the way, he didn't, got more likes and shares than real news.
It was not the case that the fake news outperformed real news in aggregate. It was with these particular stories,
fake news
stories.
My understanding of the analysis is they looked specifically at political news because that was the point of the examination. So like the fake news stories actually outperformed the real news stories in the last few months of the election. And the thing is, bad information leads to bad decisions. You need an informed and discerning electorate. And I really think, you know, I would like to see Facebook got rid of its human editors on these issues several months back. I'd like to see them bring back some real journalists and get this right.
Wouldn't that be nice? Hector or Kalina, do you have a very quick last thought on this? We've got about 20 seconds.
All right. It's basically misinformation. Misinformation can't be good in any case. And the majority of people, I really think, don't fact check. So it carries weight. Kalina.
All righty. Well, I'm sure this will be a topic of conversation at Thanksgiving tables everywhere in a matter of days. It's Friday, and we're in the break room. And just ahead, the break room gang is going to talk about campaign promises and whether the Trump campaign, Trump presidency in waiting is going to fulfill those promises. We're going to talk about cyberbullying and whether downtown Atlanta should start looking a little bit more like Times Square. Stick with us. This is On Second Thought. Downtown, just listen to the music of the traffic in the city. Linger on the sidewalk where the neon signs are pretty. How can you lose? The lights are much brighter. We're having coffee and conversation in the break room as we do each Friday. My guests are John Jackson. He's a veteran and a farmer in Milledgeville, and he's joining us via Skype. Natalie Pavelski is the vice president and senior writer at Cater Communications. Hector Fernandez, director of the Center for Latin American and Latino Studies at Georgia State University, is with us, along with Kalina Bowler, co-host of the Real Snobs podcast. We want to thank Savannah Coffee Roasters for donating the coffee that is fueling our break room guests this morning. They're online at savannahcoffee.com. Now, before the break, we were talking about... what were we talking about? We were talking about fake news. That's right. And speaking of the veracity of information, the Oxford Dictionary has chosen post-truth, the compound word post-truth, as its 2016 International Word of the Year. The publisher says that that word has dominated both the conversation about the Brexit referendum in the UK and the U.S. presidential election. Post-truth, instances of post-truth increased 2,000% over the past year. So let's ask ourselves, is this lexicographic, that's probably not the right word, increase in occurrences of post-truth indication of an actual increase in post-truth in our society? I'll define post-truth, I suppose, as a standard of civic discourse that disregards the veracity of facts altogether and simply goes straight for whether or not arguments move us emotionally. Yes. Kalina, are we living in a post-truth society?
Yes. Thank you. Thank you. I'll be here all week.
No, it's okay. It's all right. You don't need to support that with evidence because it's a post-truth society.
There you go. There it is.
But there is evidence. There is evidence. You look at the Pulitzer Prize-winning news site PolitiFact, and they fact-check mm-hmm. candidates and political leaders, and it's really transparent. I mean, they walk you through their arguments so you can see whether you agree with them or not. And they rate statements as true, mostly true, half-true, mostly false, completely false, or liar, liar, pants on fire. Okay, so all the candidates lie, and we know this. We're grown-ups, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
Sure.
Like Hillary had 26% of the time they rated her statements as lies. But PolitiFact rated 70% of Donald's statements as false. So that means if something he tells you a fact, it's more likely than not that it's false. And yet his supporters talk about him as a straight shooter.
PolitiFact, that's an indication there's selection bias there because PolitiFact is not ranking every single statement that comes out of their mouths. They are rating the veracity of statements that they have chosen to examine. So there could be some selection bias there.
Not on this order. I mean, it's pretty consistent that a lot of the candidates will get about, you know, somewhere between 20 and 30. And what they do is they look at verifiable statements. So if they wouldn't fact check, for example, when Trump says, I can fix this, trust me, they don't check that. But if he uses a statistic or says mm-hmm. that President Obama was screaming at a protester when there's videotape evidence that he wasn't, that they will rate. And this is hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of facts that they've checked over the course of the campaign. It's not just a handful. It's a pretty good source. And you can look at it and judge for yourself. And I encourage you to.
I absolutely agree with you. And I would argue that this issue permeates past politics. I mean, we've got post-truth in every aspect of culture at this point. I mean, we're basing how we feel about certain celebrities, about certain journalists. You know, it's just, it becomes a whole thing where even right. in our own families, it's like, well, this is what's going on. Well, that's not true. I feel it's true. And it's become a thing, and it's really disturbing.
John Jackson in Milledgeville, do you think that it's that people are fooled by the lies they hear from politicians, or that they just don't care and they figure, look, this politician is lying in the service of advancing an agenda that I agree with?
I don't think people are fooled. I think they are conditioned. And what I mean by that is that, you know, we live in a society where we're so emotionally engaged on everything that we do. I mean, it is definitely a black and white issue, not in the term of race, but in the term of, you know, what you believe in. And any type of post-truth becomes organic within those realities. Mm-hmm. And they grow legs and they run. And they run with people's emotions. And it's really hard to kind of reel that back in to, you know, to in your sector to kind of discern, like, you know, what's factual, what's not, because people's emotions are totally, you know, they're off the charts this whole election. And even now, they're just off the charts.
Hector, last word on post-truth goes to you.
I have a different angle. I think it's magical thinking. And people, when they embrace magical thinking, at the very least, you get disappointed. At most, you get hurt, but it's dangerous. So I definitely think, and that said, I don't believe in objectivity, right? I believe all truths are, you know, versions or whatever you want, but magical thinking is not good.
All right, let's talk about something totally different. Clear our palates. Okay. If you like the bright lights of New York City's Times Square, Atlanta may soon get its own version. The Atlanta Business Chronicle reports a proposed city ordinance would create the Atlanta Arts and Entertainment District for most of downtown. And if that ordinance goes through, current limits on video screens, billboards, blade signs, lighting, they would change, and the floodgates would kind of open up. So, folks, do we think that this is a good idea?
Yes.
Sign of the times, or would it create distractions for drivers? Would it make Atlanta look chintzy? What do you think, Hector?
No, it would be wonderful. I mean, I support anything that brings life to downtown. As long as the lighting and the signage is energy efficient, I'm cool with it. I mean, people have to make peace with the fact that Atlanta, as any civilized place, should have a 24/7 district. And if you go to downtown, I don't care what people say about games and things of that sort. After 12, it's dead. I mean, I want that place to be alive and kicking. If the lighting brings it on, hey, great.
I Does advertising equal life, though?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, the advertising, you'd be amazed. I mean, the lights do have an effect. People feel safe about it. People feel like they can actually celebrate out in the streets. It doesn't bring crime or anything of the sort. Giuliani should know about it. He was the one who made the whole shit.
It sounds like there's a dissenting voice up there in Atlanta.
No, I don't know about descending. I'm for it 100%. I just want somebody to go out in the middle of Forsyth and Walton and just, you know, turn around and have the doe-eyed look in their eye and throw up a hat and talk about how they made it to downtown Atlanta, Georgia. It's downtown. You know, well, I can't wait.
I think
this.
Hector's right about the 24/7 city, but I don't think changing a sign ordinance gets us anywhere near it. Mm. And the thing is, it's such a broad area that, you know, it's not concentrated at all. So what we could end up with is just these horrible eyesore advertising popping up here and there.
They should pick up an area. They should pick something central and concentrate that and start bringing in 24-hour diners and places where people can buy, you know, T-shirts at 3 in the morning.
It's a beginning. It's a beginning.
Let's have Peachtree Center Mall open 24 hours or something like that. There absolutely needs to be something like that.
Starting with the advertising, I have my doubts about that. You got to give people a reason to go that's beyond a bunch of lights.
Well, you have CNN right there. I mean, CNN could have news 24/7 going on.
Gee, what a concept.
There you go.
Since I worked there back when
there
it was
you go.
That.
Hey, John Jackson in Milledgeville, not a whole lot of bright signs and, you know, big lights, big city going on in Milledgeville, but you have a totally lovely little downtown strip that I have seen is quite active at night. And I suppose the key ingredient there might not necessarily be signs, but college students.
Right. I mean, college students are great. You know, I'm a farmer. I live out in the country, so it's good. But going to Atlanta, you know how us country folk feel about going to Atlanta. I mean, they can't even figure out how to drive yet and get off the road and do what they need to do. And it's going to make our premium pork that Atlanta wants so much more expensive because we can't get to where we need to go. You know, I mean, it's amazing the traffic that's up there. I'm all for it. I'm from Jersey to New York, and you know, I've seen the big lights, and they're great. But I'm not sure if Atlanta is ready to absorb all the extra attention.
I think we're looking at this from the perspective of drivers. I mean, what makes Times Square work is it's a commuter area. You can get there by train or bus or whatever, on foot. And so this could be more of an argument for MARTA expansion and, you know, trying to keep as many cars off the road as possible in that area.
Absolutely. It's not about cars.
If you're just joining us, folks, we're hanging out in the break room with Natalie Pavelski, vice president and senior writer at Cater Communications, Kalina Bowler, co-host of the Real Snobs podcast, Hector Fernandez, director of the Center for Latin American and Latino Studies at Georgia State University, and with us via Skype is John Jackson. He's a veteran and a farmer living in Milledgeville. Let's talk about something that was written in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution recently. Op-ed columnist Kyle Wingfield wrote that the word racist has been used too much and is now almost devoid of meaning. Wingfield is a white man, I should say. In a column written the day before the election, he wrote that Donald Trump supporters are, quote, not cowed by the accusations that Trump is or tolerates the support of those who are a racist or a misogynist or a bigot. Those labels have lost their effectiveness. Wingfield went on to write, the left's self-appointed police of right-wing extremism have lost all credibility with anyone who might even dream of voting Republican. They have been crying extremist for decades now. So, folks, I'm not necessarily going to ask you to endorse or deny Wingfield's entire argument, but let's just take the one question, which is, do we think that accusations of racism are being thrown around a little bit too much and thus they are losing their punch? I don't know who wants this one first.
Okay. If
jump on that, Kalina.
Here's the black woman speaking.
Thank you.
If we are going to sit here and say that the term racism has lost its meaning, then why are people like him so pressed to get us to stop saying it and calling people out for being racist, for saying racist things, for being misogynist?
What Wingfield would say is that he wants people to call out racism. He wants racism to be called out when there's real racism going on.
Right.
And right now, sort of, you know, half of the country is getting kind of immune to the accusation. It's losing all meaning, and thus it's not doesn't really sting when it really needs to be deployed.
Mm. Well, words do get stale with repeated use. The language changes all the time, and I write for a living, so I work on this a little bit. And I don't mind if we mix it up a bit. I mean, I don't mind if we say anti-black or anti-woman or anti-Latino occasionally. You miss the broader picture, the whole other versus us kind of talk. But I'm sorry, I'm not saying this correctly.
Let me jump in while you're thinking how to bring this up. I feel like there should be people out here who are absolutely calling out racism for racism's sake. I think there should be people that are not afraid to open their mouths. And when you have people that say, you know what, stop saying these words, stop doing this, stop doing that, that sounds a lot like someone patting me on the head and saying, you know what, Kalina, you don't really know what you're talking about. Okay, right. I live this.
And you can't fight something if you can't name it.
Absolutely.
Well, just because it's overused, that doesn't mean it doesn't apply to a bunch of people. Perhaps the extent of racism in our society is so pervasive, you have to use it a lot. I mean, have they ever considered that?
There you go.
John, do you want to touch this one with a 10-foot pole?
I'll pull out my 20-foot pole and I'll talk about it. But, yeah, you know, I have my ideas on this whole thing. You know, I'm a African-American redneck, pretty much. So, you know, I'm pretty unique in my perspective with regards to racism. I know racism. I know racist people. I mean, I've experienced racism. At the end of the day, when someone tells me that, hey, this guy's racist, and I'm like, well, what did he do? He said, well, he don't like me. He treats me bad. I'm like, well, why does he treat you bad? Well, I showed up late to work, and he's giving me a hard time. I'm like, no, you showed up late to work. That's why he gives you a high. It has nothing to do with your race. It has everything to do with your work ethic or who you are as a person. And so what we try to do is convolute a person's action on them versus what they have actually brought to the table. And if it doesn't go your way, we scream racism. And that's what's happening a lot. And I think that's why that editorial came out. And I see that a lot. So let's call it out for what it is, and let's stop throwing all this other stuff out for what it isn't.
All right, let's try to sneak in one more topic here. Words. Speaking of words, electric words. Twitter is they say they're going to roll out some new features designed to cut down on online abuse or people's perceptions of online abuse. They're going to allow users to mute certain tweets containing certain key words or phrases. So if you don't want to hear about anything having to do with Hillary Clinton, you can simply mute Hillary Clinton, and no tweets containing the words Hillary Clinton will show up in your feed. Hector, are there any words that you would want to mute from your experience of social media?
I would mute two things. I would mute stream profanity, and not because I'm a prude, but basically because it shows somebody has impoverished vocabulary, and it shows lack of ingenuity. And I would also mute hate speech, basically. But, you know, the best option is just to stop using Twitter.
I suppose that is an option. Mm-hmm.
I don't like this idea. I think all of these things, that these last few topics, are kind of related. This post-truth, fake news, people, you know, listening to what they want to hear, seeing what they want to see, feeling how they want to feel, and saying this is the absolute truth because I feel this way. It's not good. Not everything in life has to be sheltered from. If you just are offended by something, say, oh, that was offensive, but move on. You know what I mean? Unless now if things are becoming so bad that it's completely endangering yourself in a way of life, you know, that's a different story. But if you're just offended by someone using profanity or somebody who, you know, said something racist, yeah, there's like crazy people out there on Twitter and on social media entirely. But you don't know, you know, I don't know, people, it's First Amendment rights. You get to say what you want to say. And if you, I don't know, if you want to shelter yourself, that's fine. But, you know,
you
can't
also get
keep
to decide,
sheltering yourself.
You also get to decide what you read, right?
Yeah, you can decide what you want to read. But yeah. I don't know if it's something that's necessary. I'm not so much a fan of, you know, the trigger warnings and safe spaces all the time, everywhere, 24/7. That's just me, though.
All right. Well, we're out of time on The Break Room today. Thanks to my guests, Hector Fernandez, director of the Center for Latin American and Latino Studies at Georgia State University, Kalina Bowler, co-host of the Real Snobs podcast, Natalie Pavelski, vice president and senior writer at Cater Communications, and John Jackson, a veteran and a farmer in Milledgeville, who joined us via Skype. Thank you guys all so much. Have yourself a great weekend.
Same thing.
Have a good weekend.
Good meeting you guys. Take care.
And that's it for the show today. But as always, we want to hear from you. If you could block any word or phrase on Twitter, what would it be? What do you want to cut out of your worldview as you experience it through social media? You can let us know on social media. We're on Twitter at OSTTalk. I hope that's not going to be a phrase you're going to block. You can also let us know at facebook.com/OnSecondThoughtRadio. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Hadley. Have yourself a great weekend.